Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Beyond the Horror, Gardens, Ghettos and Georgina. Jocelyn Wilcox makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was last here discussing with the then Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, Australian foreign policy, but tonight she's talking about her PhD thesis in motion titled Gardens and Ghettos. And Jacqueline Wilcox is also Senior Vice President at Weber Shandwick. And making a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute is Gabriella Kovac, on the occasion of the publication of her book Georgina, She Beat the Holocaust. So on the topic of Gardens, Ghettos and Georgina, we'll lead off with Gabriella Kovac, and then we'll go to Jacqueline Wilcox, and then, as usual, we'll go to questions and discussion. Gabriella, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Jared, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your attendance and for allowing me to have the opportunity to tell you about my book, Georgina. Since the beginning of time and life on Earth, man's goal has been to achieve freedom and to overcome oppression. Don't you agree? My mother, Georgina's life, is the story of how she, as an individual Jewess, dealt with the suppression of her country in Hungary. As a small child, I heard the stories about how some of my family died and then how some of them also survived during the occupation by Nazi Germany. In this book, I've wrote it because I felt that the adventures of my father, who or my uncle, I'm not going to talk about that today, only about my mum. I think they were the unsung heroes in this book. And I've dedicated the book to them, and I'm doing all of this because of them, as a thank you. You will read in this book also an accurate and historical fact of those times which resulted from years of extensive research. I can vouch for Georgina's incredible ability to survive during World War II. She had the impossible task of getting penicillin to save her baby daughter, just straight after World War II. And to obtain penicillin in those times, can you imagine, in a devastated and ransacked country? And here I am today. She then managed to keep her family prosperous during the next assault through the country over the Soviet occupation in the 1950s. Her extraordinary life challenges inspired me to write the story, not just for them, but also for the benefit of the future generations, so they don't forget and use some of this information to help handle our own adversities in our own lives. Georgina dealt with overwhelming obstacles, and she treated it as a game and flourished in the process. Yes, her story is about the Second World War and also the Soviet occupation in Hungary. But it's much, much more than that. It's about how we can overcome our own challenges in today's lives. I think we all learn from Georgina. My mother died in around 2000, but before her death, I wrote a poem, but I was so fascinated, I just wanted to talk to her, and I just said, did this happen, did this happen, did this happen, and wrote it in a point-by-point form, and it took 7 pages. And she said, yes, it's correct, it's true, 7 pages, a lifetime. Well, the 7 pages became 20 pages, and then the 20 pages now is over 150 pages of unpadded information, and many reading it are inspired. Comparing in today's world of psychiatry and pill popping to handle our oppressions, 70 years ago, Georgina overcame her obstacles and near death threats daily by confronting them head on and winning. Georgina's story shows that when a threat comes to us, we can deal with it in different ways. And we all do. We can run from it. We can pretend it doesn't exist. We can give in to it. Or we can fight. And by far, that's the best option. The other options, we will eventually regret or die as a consequence. Millions were killed in World War II. Some 8 million men, women, and children were slaughtered. 6 million of these were Jews. They died not as soldiers in a war, but because of a madman named Hitler. So how on earth did Georgina survive? The first thing she did was change her hair color to blonde, and I'm got blonde. And then, she's a very good friend, she's got a false passport. And she knew the risk. But she would rather fight than be slaughtered and killed. Once the war was over, the first thing she did, even under communism, was wear a gold star. And she never, ever, all her life, I remember wearing a gold star. Never took it off. What can we learn from this? When you are threatened, think outside the square. Outsmart your enemies. Georgina always managed to think outside the square. And she always outsmarted her enemies. For example, she set up a cottage industry under communism. And she kept her family in a style of plenty. That's why I've got the gold on the side of the book. While the citizens of her country were near starvation and had to even line up for bread as the country's wealth was shifted off to Mother Russia. Her favorite saying was, "The streets are paved with gold. One just has to know how to pick it up." And Georgina definitely knew how to pick up the gold. Personally, my most momentous experience of my mother's extraordinary power was in the 1950s. We were woken up by my uncle. My uncle was hiding out in our flat because he was a wanted man already. And so he shook us awake. And he said, "The secret police are at the door and they're going to arrest your mother." You can imagine how we felt. So we were ushered, he disappeared, and my father, my grandmother, my brother, and me were ushered into the main room, the lounge in our house. I was 4 years old at the time. one of the secret policemen picked me up, put me on his knee, and started questioning me, questioning a four-year-old child. I was absolutely petrified. And then my mother swept into the room wearing that dressing gown. Can you imagine? If you have a look at it, it's handmade, woven silk. All the stitching is done by hand, and it's designed specially for her. This is in the 1950s, under communism, when the rest of the country was in doldrums and poverty. She pointed to the man and said in a voice, expecting no opposition, "Put that child down." Would you believe he did? And there, you couldn't drop a pin in that room. There was deadly silence until she came back. Mother's other motto was, never show fear in confronting your enemy. As even a dog can smell fear, and it will bite you. So true. Georgina only stayed in Hungary's worst prison. Some people might have heard of it. You can always have a look at it on the website. It's called the House of Terror. And she stayed there for 10 days. After she was released, you're not going to believe this, they sent her a bill for the pleasure of her company. Unbelievable. So, I hope this small insight into Georgina's life and some of her achievements will inspire you to buy the book, read it, and use it to overcome your own challenges in your own lives. And thank you again very much for having me here. Oh, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so honoured to be sharing this act with Gabriella and with her mother, Georgina. What an inspiring story. My story is really a story of transformation, and my work in progress is from Eden to Gomorrah, ghetto gardens, gardeners, and their representation in historical documents, memoir and literature. And for many of you will know that next week, April the 19th, is the 71st anniversary of the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And that's the time when many of us acknowledge the extraordinary Jewish resistance against the Nazi occupiers. Now, historians have posited that Jewish resistance, like that of Georgina during the Holocaust, occurred more than has been conventionally accepted. That is, as the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising reminds us, they did not go as lambs to the slaughter. Now, included in that pantheon of Holocaust resistance and transformation should, I say, should rest the Adams and Eves, or the Israels and Sarahs, who produced their own food and even flowers in makeshift gardens scratched out in the ghetto wastelands like Warsaw and Lodz. Nature, garden and agriculture language frequently form metaphors for ghetto life in memoir, diary entries and other literature that have emerged from the Holocaust. Now, let me share with you an observation of a Jewish doctor at the Warsaw Ghetto Hospital who watched a column of Jews lumbering their way along the well-worn path to the Umschlagplatz, the place where they would be transported to their deaths at the Treblinka extermination site. Above this wretched trail, on the non-Jewish side of that divided street, a woman, dressed bizarrely in a floral housecoat, watered a window box of flowers. Now, the doctor studied this woman's insouciance to the Jews in the street beneath her, and she wrote, "She must have seen that procession below, but she carried on watering her flowers. And on this side, they kept going past. They kept going past, and there seemed to be no end." Now, for the purposes of my research, the cameo serves to illustrate the pathos of the garden narrative in illuminating the stories of the ghetto. Now, according to that Jewish doctor in the ghetto, the woman's view from the other side, from her window on that infernal world, stopped at her flowers. What of the actual gardeners in the ghetto? We do know from scant documents and even photographs that individual and communal garden projects were undertaken with varying degrees of success. Ghetto gardeners were inventive. As this description by short story writer and Holocaust survivor Ruckmuel Brix reveals, the ghetto Jews went to extraordinary lengths to plant gardens. He wrote, "On the empty plots of ground between the crowded buildings, on bits of soil which the sun never reached, Jews planted gardens. Soil? It was composed of coal dust, bits of broken bricks, stone, glass, soil such as that could never have thirsted to become fruitful. Still, Jews put such pain and drudging toil into their gardening. Jews dug up the cobblestone pavements to get a bit of earth. Some of them even strewed earth over the pavement." Now, in the larger ghettos, administrations were set up to organise plantings, to supervise cultivation, to tax cultivation, and even train gardeners with special courses in agriculture. Indeed, the Jewish Holocaust experience of transforming barren lands in the Nazi-designed ghettos of Eastern Europe into fertile gardens and crops begins with the biblical narrative of the power of the garden to transform and produce life. It's in the Bible that we first learn of captured Jews herded into desolate, overcrowded lands where they are forced to survive without the necessities to sustain life. So in Exodus, we read, "And the desolate shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land that was desolate is become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited." And in Jeremiah, we learn of God's entreaty to capture Jews, whom I, he said, have caused to be carried away, that they should plant gardens, eat the food they produce, and not submit to false prophets, rather to keep alive faith and hope. Now, these biblical quotations give some sort of cultural and social reference, I submit, to the history of the Jewish struggle to survive under capture and expulsion. And it's what has now become mythologised as the Jewish tradition of coping against hostile surroundings. Teenage ghetto diarist David Seriakoviak told us much about what tending plants meant to him in just two lines. While noting his mother's work in a community garden in the Lodz ghetto, he wrote that if he had that job, he'd eat his fill of beet seeds. Bernard Gottfried recalled that the garden of his tiny house in the Warsaw ghetto held his last memories of his mother before she was transported to Treblinka. Like Seriakoviak, Gottfried did not describe the garden nor its place in his family's struggle for survival. Rather, it was where his devastated mother sat on a bench by a lilac tree and cried. In the Bialystok ghetto, Jakub Goldberg was concerned that the Nazi order for the ghetto to be reduced by a third would mean the loss of his vegetable garden, and that's all we know of what Jakob thought about the directive and of his garden. Similarly, the garden appears to have withered from formal ghetto history through a lack of nourishing detail. While ghetto garden plots and communal agricultural projects are briefly detailed in some memoir and historical records, the actual garden experience and its relationship with the people of the ghetto is rarely fully developed. Those who have spoken to me about their ghetto experiences, including in the larger ghettos of Lodz and Warsaw, which many of you might know, paradoxically, these are the ghettos with the most organised and officially chronicled gardening departments. Those people often denied or minimalised the existence of gardens. Some were offended at the subject and believed it irrelevant to Holocaust history. The ghetto, it seems, has no place for such a seemingly anodyne occupation as gardening or agriculture. But Shiva Glasvina provides a counterpoint. She records that the small garden, cultivated from forlorn ground by children in the Lodz ghetto orphanage, gave hope. However, their despair at the news that they were to be transported prompted them to lash out violently and destroy it. It had failed them, she wrote. They had loved it, nurtured it, and watched over it, and it had not heeded them nor responded to their loving care. Her words reveal the importance of the garden to the ghetto prisoner, not just for the food it might produce, which was often minimal, but for its capacity to give hope and to transform, albeit briefly. The collection of literature and memoir ensures that the noble task of building a ghetto garden is included, for me, in the pantheon of Jewish acts of resistance, ingenuity, and the belief in the transformative effect of nature. And as I hope to develop, the work of ghetto poets and fiction writers is a similarly revelatory, I always stumble over that word, as that of memoirists and diary writers. It provides a symbolic counterpart to the literal. It fills gaps in knowledge created by a lack of evidence. And it gives life to and often confirms that information which is found in some of the archives of the larger ghettos. And it also, it provides what archivists cannot. It's an insight into the ghetto Jews' emotional suffering at the denial of nature and beauty. Chava Rosenfarb's fictional trilogy, The Tree of Life, written soon after her own liberation from the Lodz ghetto, is rich with such garden detail. It includes information about agriculture projects undertaken by the different political groups and the kibbutzim, including details of organised practical garden courses and lectures. She writes of the transformation of pebbled streets into garden plots and the assembling of window box and balcony gardens. Her observations are echoed by other fiction writers and they're confirmed in official ghetto chronicles and Judenrat records. We have Lithuanian poet Avram Sutskeva. He was in the Vilna ghetto, and he wrote many poems, including Flower, in 1943. The poem describes the physical punishment a man in the ghetto endured just to see a flower. The black and blue marks of his punishment for such a crime were, for Sutskeva, similar, or they were the indicators of the changing seasons found in nature. Short story writer Ishaya Spiegel was in the Lodz ghetto, and he used nature as a metaphor for Jewish despair and isolation. Spiegel wrote of the paradox that was the deathly land of the ghetto and the fertile land which was the Jewish cemetery. It was the cemetery where the dead lay buried that showed signs of life. In his popular memoir of the Warsaw ghetto, The Pianist, and some of you may have seen the film, Władysław Spielman used imagery from nature to depict the period of calm that followed a brutal roundup of Jews for transportation to their deaths. Spielman wrote that the month after the viciousness passed peacefully. To underscore that piece, he describes the flowers and the blossoms that emerged somewhat incongruently during that bloody aftermath. And it was as though the plants had memorised the tempo of nature and pushed through the violence and horror. Like the buds that were about to follow their preternatural cycle and blossom into blooms, even in the ghetto, a world that followed no norms, so too, he wrote, the Germans remembered their murderous mission and sprouted into action. The two deeds contrast as natural to each genus, that is, flora that blooms and Nazis who kill. He wrote, it was May, and even in the ghetto, lilac blossomed here and there. Just as the flowers were about to come out fully, the Germans remembered us. But it's the language of spring, associated as it is with the end of cold and dark winter and the beginning of new life, that is most often used by ghetto memoirists to contrast their existences. They describe how, unlike the sparse strips of nature and the scrappy gardens that were scattered throughout the ghetto, their lives would not be so renewed. The physical and metaphorical winter, the darkness and gloom of their unbearable lives, would not be punctuated with a symbol of its ending. Spring, in turn, did not provide them with nature's optimistic signposts of new life and hope. That cycle of life had bypassed them. Ghetto diarist Chaim Kaplan wrote that Jews have been robbed of every tree and every flower, and in doing so, he invokes the Jewish tradition that places the tree as a symbol for growth, responsibility, and stability. Trees are lifelines, as exhibited in Genesis' Tree of Knowledge and Tree of Life, and in God's instruction in Leviticus for Jews to plant fruit-bearing trees. And so it is in such ghetto literature that we find confirmation of the importance and the pathos of the nature narrative in telling the stories of suffering and existence. But it's more than a narrative or theme. It provides the root language to describe what is absent and what's been denied, growth, rejuvenation, the cycle of life. Indeed, references to nature in times of severe persecution have a long history in Jewish storytelling. As I've mentioned, the Bible speaks to Jews of such transformative properties, and as well, ghetto poets like Sutskeva write of those so transformed after sneaking a flower into their miserable homes that the consequent violent punishment was almost worth it. In longing references to the gardens and nature experiences denied them, the Jewish ghetto writers highlight its importance by invoking its absence. This is particularly so for ghetto children. 12-year-old Zara Ziskin made it her duty to teach nature and gardens to children in her care in the Lodz ghetto. She recalled that they had never seen a flower and had no understanding of nature. And in one of the earliest survivor memoirs, David Vodobinsky wrote of ghetto children seeing nature for the first time on the way to their deaths. In the stiflingly crowded trains to Treblinka and Auschwitz, they were able to glimpse the countryside as adults held them up in their boxcars, windows for some air. And he wrote, "In this way, thousands of children on their first and last trip in their lives saw a tree or a flower for the first time. These were 5 and 6-year-olds who grew up in the ghetto. He said the ghetto had everything, but it had no trees nor flowers." Janusz Korczak, the founder of Warsaw Ghetto's most famous orphanage, wrote of his orphans' desire to become acquainted and make friends with nature. In a letter to the local priest, whose church was still in the boundaries of the ghetto, it remained in the boundaries of that ghetto for some time, and the children wrote to the priest, "We long for a little air and greenery. It's stuffy and crowded where we are. We want to become acquainted and make friends with nature. We shall not damage the plants. Please don't refuse us." Historian Yehuda Bauer ascribed the Hebrew term amidah, which literally means standing up against, for those acts which preserve dignity and prolonged life. He included obtaining food and other morale-building activities in the grouping that could be labelled amidah. Now, I'm inclined toward the teenage diarist Yitzhak Rudaszewski's view when he included the gardeners in the Vilna ghetto as in his long list of those who passively resisted the Nazis and provided a symbol of the Jews' enduring faith in the redemptive power of the Spirit. This redemptive power is illustrated in the biblical words of Isaiah and often used as a comfort to exiled Jews. Now, for the purposes of this paper, those exiled Jews were those imprisoned in the ghettos of Eastern Europe. And I'll just quote Isaiah, "For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden and her desert like Eden and her desert of the garden of the Lord." So in the ghettos, gardens, no matter how primitive, nurtured, sustained, and reflected the cycle of the ghettos and their prisoners. Rosenfarb described this effectively when her fictional Lodz Jews took their last look at the gardens as they boarded the trains to the camps. She wrote, "The smell of pears, apples, and cherries filled their nostrils. They felt as if they themselves were fruit filling the open snouts of empty, hungry boxcars." From the ashes of the ghetto gardens tended in the Nazi-created Gomorrah, we have memorial gardens to honour the dead and those who managed to survive. The gardens of Theresienstadt and Auschwitz and other former prison and ghetto sites now provide memorials to those who perished and endured. The symbolism of renewal, peace and returning to nature or to God, so inherent in these gardens, has its genesis in the biblical depiction of the Garden of Eden as the birthplace of civilization. The antithesis of birth, as you know, is death, and so it's apposite that the end of being is neatly bookended in gardens that serve to memorialise the lifeless, who, as Jeremiah says, will not sorrow anymore. Thank you.
So thanks to Gabriela Kovac and Jacqueline Wilcox. We've got some copies of Gabriela Kovac's book here, and I'll be happy to sell them after the function this evening. So we'll go to no later than the top of the hour, but perhaps a bit before then. So we'll do the normal questions and discussion. There's plenty of time, so we can get through everything. I'll just go back to you, Gabriela. Obviously, from the book, your mother's a very ingenious and clever person, but she's also probably a very lucky person. I'm not an expert on Hungary, but as I understand it, the Germans went into Hungary late in the war, but when they did go in, the roundup of the Jews in Budapest and other cities was pretty ruthless and pretty all-embracing. So in other words, you needed a bit of luck, a bit of good fortune, not to be rounded up and sent off to Auschwitz, as most were going to then, because a lot of clever people, a lot of people who are very able, did get picked up and did get killed. So do you think your mother was lucky, or was she only lucky, or was there more to it than luck? If you just talk to the back of the room.
Come here?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Good. Yeah. Okay, well, if you open the book, it actually, I do think, this is my personal belief, that my grandfather had some idea of what was going to happen. And if you start from the, okay, from the beginning of the book, it actually starts with what he did. He actually groomed her, and he kept telling her that she was in a magic bubble, and nothing will harm her in the magic bubble. And you'd have to have known Georgina. She actually believed. No, it wasn't even belief. She knew she was in a bubble. I can't explain it to anyone. It was the most amazing thing. She knew she was in a bubble, and nothing will harm her.
Sorry.
Hang on just a second. I'll call you in every time. But even if she knew that, that doesn't mean she's going to escape, does it? I mean, it's... She had self-belief, but you need more than self-belief to escape, don't you? I mean, because I don't think someone's going to kill me doesn't mean someone's not going to kill me. So
of course
what
not.
What more did she have beyond self-belief?
Well, I think also she was a very clever woman. And when she realized, she did get the false passport, she did tint her hair blonde. And there was, I think, a lot of luck and a lot of intention to survive. She was also pregnant at the time, so it was pretty amazing.
Right, so there's a question down the back.
Yes, sorry.
Sorry, I just wanted just to clarify, did you know your mother quite well, or you were very, very young at the time?
I just want to pick up for the podcast here. The question is, how well you knew your mother?
In Hungary, I didn't know her very well. I actually got to know her when we came to Australia. She was too busy handling the black market and basically providing for us. But when we came to us, I always had to call her mother, and it was a very great respect. But I always say my grandmother really brought me up. But when we came to Australia, yes, I did meet my mother, and that's when I was very close to her.
And would you say that she had a very, very strong will to
survive? Incredible. Unbelievable. Incredible.
Stuart.
Did your mother ever make a distinction between who was the worst, the Nazis or the Soviets?
No. No, she didn't. I think that what she was doing was didn't make a decision of that was worse. She just looked at how she's going to survive and what she had to do to survive and do well. That was...
Question here.
Sorry.
The problem for the audience is they haven't read the book.
Yes.
So could you give us some of the specific details of what your mother was doing when the war broke out, what her position was as a Hungarian? You know, she didn't have only Jewish background. There was a mixture there.
That's right.
And when you say she dyed her hair, could you give the audience some details about how she did the things she did to keep herself from being arrested? Because there were specific movements that she made.
Yes.
To survive. She wasn't just lucky, but she was also lucky. I mean, she had that tremendous... But you have to give them something to hang on, because I know what happened, but I like
the okay, well, I'll try. Yes, my family name is Glasgow. It's a love story about my great-great-great-grandfather being Scottish, came to Hungary, married my great-great-great-grandmother, and they didn't look, I suppose, they didn't have a Jewish look about them. But if you look at that photo that it's on the front of the book, that's her false passport. Now, if you look inside the book, I'll just see if I can find it. There's a picture of her. I don't know if anyone can see it. There's a picture. That's their wedding photo. And if you look at that and the difference between that, it's like night and day. It's like a different... Somehow she changed her whole outlook in life, her whole personality, from being Jewish to being that. I have no idea how she did it, which was just incredible transformation of actual personality.
What about the husband?
The husband. He was
some detail. Tell us about your father.
Oh, my father. He was again. He was...
That
was amazing, yes.
He did an enormous strategy to survive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, that's a fun part. That is the fun part of the book. Yeah, he actually met when she was riding in the countryside and her bike, the front wheel of her bike went. So he went in there and They fell in love instantly, and they got married. And he had a bike business. That's what he had. He wanted to know about the bike business. That was amazing.
How did he survive the war?
He decided when they called them up, as all Jewish men were called up, him and a couple of his friends, and there's a picture in the book about it, they decided they had acquired some bikes, and they painted a sign saying repairs, and they followed the German army saying repairs, and the bikes were never ever in one piece. They were constantly being taken apart. They made sure nobody could use the bikes. And he could repair the bikes. There was another person who could speak German, and that's about the length of it. The rest of them were it was just the front. And when the German army started to retreat, they decided that we better get out of here because now we may be found out. So then they scattered. But that was just one of the parts of being a fascinating part of his ingenuity about staying alive. Yeah.
What about the story of your mother after the birth of the baby, getting food?
That's another little interesting bit. While they were married, one of the uncles was saying that, you idiots, you don't know what you're doing, how could you squander money and food, you really should save it. So, and he had a grocery store. Now, Mum knew about that. So during the war, in 1944, I don't know if any of you know what that would have been like. There were people dying on the streets. People's heads were shot off. Anyway, she was starving, so she thought, I better get some food or die, or what's the choice here?
And she just had a baby.
And she just had the baby, and the baby wasn't having any food. So she went across town and found the grocer who was putting everything down in a bunker. And my father was already there. So.
And then what did you do?
Well, that's what he tells. But then they met, and then she actually carried over 40 kilos of food, and she wasn't 40 kilos herself. That's the bit. And they got back, and she got back home again. She had this thing: nothing's going to happen to me. I'm going, and she decided to go back. And they lived off the food to the end of the war. Yeah, amazing. Like all of it, it really did come back to this incredible ability to survive, or intention that nothing's going to harm me. I'm going to make it through.
Can I ask a follow-up question? What do you think is the core belief system, or the core genetics, or whatever, that makes people driven like that? Have you ever thought about that?
The question is, what's the core genetics that makes people driven,
not
like the way your
belief
that makes people driven the way your mother was driven?
But I think she adored her father, and he kept on telling her she was beautiful, intelligent, everybody's going to love her, and nothing's going to happen to her, and she's in a bubble. And he kept telling her and telling her and telling her. And I think that in the end, nothing was going to happen to her if you read, because the book goes all the way right down to when she went into a nursing home. They were in the nursing home, there were about 30 men and over 70, I mean 30 women and over 70 men. And guess what? She had 4 boyfriends. She was beautiful, intelligent, and nobody came near her. That was bang on. That was mother. You either loved her or hated her, but she was survival, and surviving well.
Stuart, if I understood you right, you said that the Soviet came and to visit, they put you, I think, on
not the Soviets, that was the Hungarian secret police. She got dobbed in because the guy dobbed her in because she was doing well.
There was once,
and she did exactly, and I heard about that story. She just stood on a bed. She just thought, instead of lying down, she was already very heavily pregnant, she stood on the bed, and she confronted the guy. And apparently, her hair was quite long by then, and she had this gown on, and I don't know, maybe he thought she was Mary or something. I don't know what happened there. But he just backed off and said no one can come into this room.
So other than that, her false passport and everything like that, it held up during the war?
Held up during the war. Held up. It was a very clever false passport. It was an actual living person who looked similar to her, which I found out of a lot of hard work and digging. Yeah, actually, the name on the passport is a different name to her name and a different birth and everything. And then we found out that there was a person with that name, and that was a friend of hers.
Let's go back to Jacqueline. Jacqueline, why would you write a thesis, a PhD thesis, on this topic? It's probably one of the most unlikely topics for a PhD thesis. So you won't have many rivals, I guess.
It's a niche garden.
But if...
look,
you know, at the end, I mean, there was really nothing left in the Warsaw ghetto, was there? Was virtually nothing left in Warsaw by the end of 1944. So why would you pick this topic?
Well, there were loads of other ghettos,
yes.
And in fact, what has recently been discovered is that there are probably thousands more than were ever known. And the museum, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, has just released another 2-volume encyclopedia of the ghettos, and they've discovered some hundreds, I think 700 more than was previously known. And there were gardens and agriculture projects in those ghettos, but the problem is that in the pantheon, in the stories of survival, like this amazing story of Georgina and other stories of people who were in the camps and survived the death marches, thinking about a garden that they may have tended when they were in a ghetto is probably the last thing that's in that collection of memories. And of all of the memoirs and diaries and things that I've been reading, I would come across these fantastic, noble people who would talk about being in the resistance in a ghetto. And they talked about where they met, they had their meetings at the tomato patch, and then it moved on. And I'm thinking, what happened with these tomatoes? Because you also read about a lot of starvation and people not being able to get food. And so for me, that really, I guess, prompted my interest. And then when I started, the more I started digging, the more resistance I got, actually, about looking into ghetto gardens, because people just thought it was unbelievable. And there are people who, you know, who were there who say to me, didn't happen. And that has also been for me a challenge, because, you know, if you highlight that these people, you know, their stories are true, they were there, and they say it didn't happen, what else will people challenge about their memories? And that's a real dilemma I have, given that I don't want to give anything that could give succour to deniers. But nonetheless, there are fantastic stories that should be told, that, you know, I do believe that we do need to challenge this myth that Jews just went, you know, they just got herded into these ghettos and then they went in some sort of benign way. They didn't. They fought back. And there's so much resistance. For me, gardening is resistance, because it's so rich. The stories are so rich. A lot of these people were urban people who had never gardened. It'd be as hopeless as me trying to do a potato patch, but the stories are, and the stories in the memoir and in the literature with all of the nature narratives, I find are really quite evocative, and that's just great stories. But there are other good stories of resistance that we should acknowledge. The fact that there was religious observance is incredibly brave, because for the Jews in this room who will know that for a minyan to happen, you have to have 10 men to have to get together for the prayers. Now, for 10 men to get together with their robes and to pray in a concentration camp or a ghetto was an incredible act of bravery. And we know that those things did take place. And we've seen, some of you will probably have been to in Vienna, to the Jewish Museum in Vienna, where there are still the menorah that were made for the camps that are around there, made from all sorts of little pieces that they just dug out of the camp. So those sorts of acts, I think, you know, we have to acknowledge for their bravery. So that's a long-winded answer, I'm sorry.
That's fine. There's a question there, then we go over here. Yes?
I'd like to ask Jacqueline, is there any evidence of, in the German records and archives of these guards.
Yes. Yes, and fortunately, since Russia has opened up, there are, because the Russians, many of you will know, when they got into these places, they actually took a lot of the records and they took them back to Russia, and so a lot of it's opening up. Yes, there are records. Incredibly, there's some records written in Yiddish as well from the Judenrat themselves, they're from the Jewish councils that ran the ghettos, because the people don't realise that the Jewish administrations were the major employers of these ghettos, and they were huge. They had all sorts of departments, and they had agriculture departments, and so they had to allocate land in the ghetto. And there are records now of those land allocations. And there's the beauty of it, and what Chava Rosenfarb and others write about, even in their fiction, but also in memoir, that there was a lot of corruption, particularly in Lodz ghetto, where there was corruption about who got allocated land. But there's some terrible stories. One man tells of this. I mean, these people worked really hard in factories, and then they went in their spare time and dug up their gardens. And there's some fantastic stories about one man who, every time they would grow something, people who were so hungry were marauders, and they would come and rip off the plants, any bit of greenery, and eat them before the fruit had ripened and all of that. So there were rules about that, and there were guards to guard these little trees that were around the ghettos. But one man was quite ingenious. The tragedy is, and I don't mean to break people's hearts by telling you these Gaulish stories, but after an action, when the Germans would come in and they would round people up in the ghettos to put them on trains to take them to their deaths, it wasn't, as you can imagine, it was a pretty horrible, bloody experience. And after that, in the piece that Spielmann talked about in The Pianist, the piece was actually these roads strewn with the aftermath of these families' lives being wrecked. And many of the things that were left behind were, would you believe, baby carriages, which were perfect for gardens. So what people would do was they would grab and steal these baby carriages and put whatever dirt they could and put their seeds in, and they would wheel their carriages around with them because they could then protect their produce, and they could put them when they were in the factories. They could put them in the outside of the factory and watch them whilst they were working, and they could get the sun on them. And the most common thing that was grown were spring onions because they grew rather quickly and they didn't need much dirt. But the other thing, that the reason I brought out Sierra Kowiak's acknowledgement of his mum working in the Lodz ghetto garden, that he would eat his fill of beet seeds, that's quite telling, because in that period, beetroot that we Aussies love was for animals. Good middle-class people did not eat beets. And the fact that he, as a middle-class young man, was pining to eat beet seeds is so telling, that. But yes, there are lots of diaries, and there are now records that are emerging.
Especially, you mentioned memoirs that refer to the flowers and times in the garden.
Yes.
So some people obviously remember them and remember them not romantically, not the word, but happily. Why do you think some people just deny it? They don't want to deal with that there were these difficulties of
I think a lot of people who say, look, you know, Jacqueline, you're crazy, I was there and there was not one garden. I think that is true. That is their true memory of that. And in the horror that they have survived, a garden is so minimal, really, when we think about the memories that they do have. So I just think that for many people it wasn't a big deal in their lives. And to go back, it challenges what we understand of ghettos. And the problem here is for us to do it with great elegance and compassion, that we acknowledge that these people have these memories for which the gardens do not exist. But we also must acknowledge that actually there is a lot of record. There's photographs of gardens, big agricultural plantations with scarecrows. Can you believe this? In Lodz ghetto, with scarecrows with Jewish Star of David on it. Very famous photograph. And one of the most famous chroniclers or historians, pardon me, Ringelblum, many of you will know from Warsaw, who was in the Warsaw Ghetto. He's a famous historian even before he was incarcerated in Warsaw Ghetto. And he set out his life's mission was to get people to write the stories of what day-to-day life was like in the ghetto. And so you had these great people writing all sorts of social histories that many of them were stored in milk cans and hidden, and they were discovered in the 50s in Warsaw. And so from there we have his acknowledgement of the garden projects that were underway. Not a lot. We think that the chapter that's missing is actually the chapter that has, wouldn't you know it, the gardens in it. So to answer your question, I think that for many people, this, you know, the nurturing that we have after the Holocaust, when we were hearing, and many of us didn't want to hear, so they had to overcome that. We were hearing people's stories. People didn't want to tell their stories, so it took some time. And so I think that the garden just got lost in that sort of rich tapestry of what they went through.
Yes, I'd like to ask if you were reading your sources in English or in translation?
No, I'm afraid I'm dreadful. I'm barely literate as an English reader, and that's about it. I'm very fortunate that the Jewish community that I've managed to tap into is full of some fantastic scholars who have time on their hands, and some of them have been so generous and translated for me and given me some of them. But no, I'm afraid I have to do it in English.
What are they translating from? Polish? Or
Polish and Yiddish and German.
So there are some photographs?
Yes, there are.
And sketches maybe?
Sketches, you're right, but photographs, yes. And there's some photographs that the Nazis themselves took. You know, they were great photographers. I mean, ghettos were actually, can you believe it, they were tourist attractions. People actually went to Warsaw and Lodz to check it out. This is a look at the Jews, and they took photographs of them. They took photographs of the Jews lying in the streets dying, or they took photographs of the rich side of the Lodz ghetto, where people were in cafes and had lovely fashions, and there were beauty, you know, had their nails done and all of that. So there was this different worlds in the ghetto. It wasn't just one bleak life. It was bleak, but there were rich people in the ghetto and there were very poor people in the ghetto. But yes, people, they took their own photographs. There were some very brave photographers who managed to take photographs and hide them, and they were discovered some time after. But most of the things we have are the writings. So the poet Sutskever, who wrote the poem Flower, which is quite telling, you know, about the man who was beaten black and blue. But most of the stuff I'm getting is just going through these memoirs and finding little bits. One in Warsaw, this woman was living on the other side. You know, very brave people who were blonde or whatever could live on the other side, and they would smuggle back into the ghetto, smuggle food, smuggle guns for the uprising. And she said she had been living on the outside and she was being smuggled back in to see her friends and take some things in. And she bought some a little bunch of flowers to take into her friends, and then she realised, she had to put her armband back on when she went in. She had to dump that bunch of flowers because as soon as she got in there, it was absolute telltale that she'd been on the other side and, you know, she could have been exposed. But the corruption was obvious too, because in some of it, there's a woman called Mary Berg who writes a fantastic diary that, if you're interested, you should read, and she talks about people... there was, you know, a lot of black market going on, and the chief black marketeer had a girlfriend who had a baby, and her room, these are Jews, her room in the Jewish hospital was completely full of flowers. And Mary Berg writes, you know, very scathingly about that, what that means. So there are those telltale signs.
We're getting close to the end.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you both.
Yes.
We've had so much Holocaust, the most terrible thing that we could ever remember. To what extent is there a resistance to stories that tell a more rounded picture, where it's not just marching off to the death camps? It seems from both of your stories, reaction to your book perhaps, and the fact that you find it so difficult to find these things or people don't remember.
It seems
to me that the rounded story is yet to be told, and your contribution
I think we may make this the final point, because we're running out of time. Let's start with Gabriella and finish with Jacqueline. Just go back.
Oh, okay.
But I found that through my research or through quite a lot of things, I did have a resistance on it. People didn't like me writing about somebody who won. I did have that. But then I do find that a lot of people do like the idea, and they find that it's inspirational.
It is. More and fantastic
story. But I did have a lot of problems
sure
with it in
did.
The beginning. Yeah.
I'm glad you survived it.
Thank you.
Gentlemen.
I don't think there's anything sinister in it. I actually believe that it's really confronting when people are spending their lives to tell the story, the real story of what happened. You get some little Aussie chick like me who comes up and says, but hey, they grew some flowers. That's a bit confronting. And so, you know, I understand the objection, and it's just my job to try and get underneath it and tell the story. I don't think people are resistant to telling the truth, but the fact is that so many people denied the horror for so long that we had to concentrate on that.
Okay, well, look... We've had a long question discussion period. We're getting very close to time. So I think that's a good time to finish. Many thanks to Gabriella Kovac for coming along to talk about a book, Georgina, She Beat the Holocaust. And as I said, we've got some copies up here. And thanks to Jacqueline Wilcox, and all the best with your PhD. And so we'll see how that goes. But
thanks, Jared.
Well, I'm sure it will go very well. But what I meant really was in terms of publication and all that other sort of stuff. But thanks for coming along tonight and telling us both your stories, both a personal story in Gabriella's case and a historical story in Jacqueline's case. So we're very pleased you did it. We'll publish the papers in due course. It'll be on our podcast, televised and whatever. So many thanks, Jacqueline.
Thank you, my dear.
Many thanks, Gabriella.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.